Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Astor's Economic Week in Review. Today is September 24th, and with us we have the CIO of Astor, John Eckstein. John, how are you?
I'm great, Mac. How are you doing?
I'm doing awesome. Thank you. So we were talking about the economic data from the past week, and my comment was everything looked like it's pretty much on trend, give or take a little bit in either direction. And then you said, well, there's some underlying things to talk about, some stuff that feeds into these data reports. So why don't you start off with the big picture and let's jump into the labor market. Kind of let us know what you see happening behind the scenes.
Yeah, well, I mean, so the thing is, just sort of as a meta comment, like most of the time looking at macro data is like this. Like most week's data looks a lot like last week's data. So I think that's interesting. That's kind of interesting in itself, right? Is that it seems to be in a sort of stable area and without some sort of impulse, you know, maybe a shock from the fiscal system, maybe a good or a bad COVID event. We're kind of on the path we're on for a while. You know, so again, my big picture is that we are on a tepid recovery from dramatic shutdown in March. So the way I see it, we had a big shutdown in March, and then we have a little bit of sort of in the line of the V-shaped recovery that people were talking about, where things were down a lot in March and April, up a lot in May and June. And now sort of gradually getting better, staying the same, getting a little worse, maybe, depending on the exact thing you're looking at. The big picture is that we're well below potential growth, which is what economists like to talk about. We should be growing. We're well below the level of GDP we should have. Part of that is because people still aren't acting normally. And part of that is because of regular recession stuff. People are out of work and less likely to spend money when they're out of work.
Right.
So today we had the jobless claims. We usually start with jobless claims. And this is sort of a good example of what you're talking about, Mac, where things came in very similar to last week. Overall, there's a slight increase in the number of people increasing initial claims for unemployment insurance, both the state level, a modest increase. The pandemic unemployment assistance, there was a modest decrease. And those numbers together, though, have been pretty stagnant, right? So the initial claims declined dramatically starting at sort of the middle of April and have tapered out for the last couple of months. And the pandemic unemployment insurance, the program for gig workers, has been pretty stable for the last several months too. Now, one thing to bear in mind is that the pandemic unemployment insurance is a new program. Turns out that getting checks to, you know, 20 million people is actually a tricky logistic process. There is some questions about the sort of continuing claims, the level of continuing claims there. So this week, the pandemic unemployment insurance went from almost 15 million people to like 12 million people. Is that really good news? People get a lot of jobs back. No, it's that California just stopped double counting people.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Like the continuing claims number on the pandemic unemployment insurance side is better thought of as an upper bound, right? So right now it's 11 million people and it's not more than 11 million people, but it could be substantially fewer. There's 50 states with 50 different programs and they all are quirky, right? So everybody like wants to run their own. This is really good evidence that the federal government should be running unemployment insurance full stop as far as I'm concerned. But like this, just like it's just messy, right? It's like the tech problem is just hard to solve given their resources. They've been more concerned about getting the checks out the door than they are about getting the paperwork right. So we have to take some of those PUA numbers in particular with a little bit of a grain of salt.
Yeah, and the other way, I mean, if you just stop filing on a weekly basis, do they stop counting you as unemployed? If someone just stops, you know, going into the system and updating the fact that they're still unemployed, and because there's a weekly certification, right? When do they get taken out of the jobless claims, continuing claims pool?
Well, they should get taken out the same week, but then the question is like, what happens when people, one thing that was happening in California is people were applying September 24th, I lost work on September 1st. I'm like, okay, well, you get your claim, but then you also get 3 weeks of claims. And sometimes those people were counted like three times in 1 week on the continuing claims basis. So most states have this kind of old fashioned, like mainframe type system written in COBOL that was written and improved like in the 60s. And they're trying to squeeze this new program into it and they're finding it difficult. So yeah, so what's supposed to happen is you're supposed to get, I think, and the backlogs, which has been tripping up the system a little bit.
Yeah, John, you know, the reason I ask is because Sarah, as we've talked about, my wife, she's a sole proprietor. She owns a photography business that was shut down for obvious reasons during COVID. And when she would go in and certify for her pandemic unemployment assistance every week, it was pretty clear, right? Like I'm not working. It's because of COVID. And now she is working and she's able to get out and do photography appointments and make money. and she continues to log in on a weekly basis. She's trying to find the way to indicate that she's working and that she doesn't need to be certifying anymore, and to basically take her off of this reoccurring weekly certification. And so every week she goes in and she clicks, I am working. I've made money. The amount of money I'm making is over the pandemic unemployment assistance or insurance. She doesn't get any more benefits because of that, which is great. But I just don't know if they're counting her because they keep asking her to certify. But like you just said a second ago, I think that probably since she is not getting the insurance, therefore she's not being counted in continuing claims.
Let's hope that that's the case.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, like we could see a huge revision in Illinois, just like we saw the 3 million person revision in California. And so like it could be all Sarah, who knows? So one more thing before we jump off of claims is there's another emergency program, which is for people who have exhausted their regular state claims. So state claims typically go for 26 weeks. And so there's a program that gives you an extra 13 weeks on the pandemic emergency program. That number is creeping up. The people receiving benefits under that program has been creeping up every week of the last several weeks. So now it's at 1.6 million people continuing claims under that program. And that's up 100,000 from the week before. And that's worth keeping an eye on too, right? So economists do talk about the difference between, you know, short-term and long-term unemployed. It's much difficult. Like you've been unemployed for a long time. It's difficult to get a job, whether that's, you know, we don't have to talk about the reasons for that, but it's definitely a statistical regularity. And so like we're worrying that, you know, these people have been unemployed for 26 weeks or longer, continuously unemployed for 26 weeks or longer. And that is, you know, another sort of soft spot in the labor market.
Mm-hmm. You know, so John, kind of segueing off the labor market, let's get into manufacturing. PMI came out and, you know, we've talked for, I mean, I think almost a year now on podcast. Manufacturing really was under pressure in 2019 and then obviously dipped further into COVID and has had a pretty strong bounce back. So where are we at in current levels? And is there anything underlying, you know, within the report that catches your eye?
Yeah, so this sort of continues the theme of not a lot of change. So this is the sort of lesser known purchasing managers index, the market purchasing managers index, which came in a slight improvement, but about the same as it was last month, about as expected. And so that's sort of showing an area of reasonable growth for a level we typically associate with reasonable growth for manufacturing businesses. And services is kind of the same. It's at a reasonable growth area. And so there's nothing on the US side that's really interesting there. What I thought was worth mentioning is that, so they run this report in a number of countries. The services numbers in Europe came in much, much weaker than expected and down a lot from last month. So that's something to worry about from the sort of world standpoint. I mean, so Europe has also seen a big surge in cases over the last, I don't know, 6 weeks or so.
Obviously that's correlated to the poor service numbers.
Well, I mean, who knows? Right? Yeah. It's obvious economists might have predicted it. I mean, though you never know with economists. It definitely seemed to be, and we'll see if this holds up as a preliminary number, and we'll see. But that's sort of like an early sign of weakness in Europe, which did not show up in the U.S.
Right. So, John, when you look at not so much manufacturing, but service side of the economy, something kind of that kind of leads into that is the University of Michigan consumer sentiment. And that came out last Friday. It would just catch my eye. It came in a little bit higher than expected. So the survey, people thought it would come in at 75. It came in at around 79. So a reasonable jump from where they expected it and a little bit higher than where it was on the prior report. So generally speaking, can you conclude that consumers are still feeling okay?
Yeah. So I see the big picture of the consumer sentiment number is that it's been in sort of a range since it dropped down in March and April, and it bounced back from that, but hasn't really improved from that bounce level, including today's number. So it went up, it's gone sort of up and down. And that's sort of similar to where we actually at Aster, we sort of try and take a number of sentiment indicators and extract a common theme from them. And that's showing the same thing where we're about at as optimistic as we've gotten since March, but well below normal levels.
So right? Where is a things are great number? If we're at
right, so we're going to say on our scale, things are great at a one and we're slightly below zero. And when things were really bad, they were at a negative one. So we're sort of, you know, halfway-ish back
right in the middle
where we were in 2019.
Sure.
And so one thing that's interesting there that is going to be curious is that one thing the University of Michigan does, they ask a bunch of questions and they ask a bunch of demographic data. So one of the things they do is ask people about expectations and they ask people about their political party. What you see in expectations is basically as of 2015, Democrats had substantially higher expectations than Republicans. In November 2016, that flips. So the Republicans have super high expectations compared to the Democrats. The Democrats' expectations go down, and they've stayed that way. Like, they bounce around, but the Republicans are basically just, like, much more optimistic than the Democrats. Okay. And they both went down at about the same amount with COVID, but you still have this very large gap between the two that's just related to politics, right? Wow. Worth keeping an eye on. Like, if Biden wins, if there's a Democrat sweep, which say there's a 50% chance of a Democrat, you know, House, Senate, White House, those numbers will reverse, right? Republicans are just going to be extremely pessimistic about the economy. And the Republicans are kind of the rich ones, right? And the Republicans are the ones, I think, who own more stocks. So I think that's worth bearing in mind as the election draws near.
Yeah, there's a lot to watch over the next 3 months, right? Most people can agree that we're not going to have a decision on election night, right, with the mail-in voting. And so we'll see what happens over the next 3 months. Very interesting. I like that, John. Now, I was looking at some of the housing data. It looks like the trend continues to be in favor of high demand for houses. Looks like prices, year-over-year prices or month-over-month prices increased a little bit more than expected. Mortgage applications are up. Anything surprising or any underlying comments or data that you see in these reports?
Well, I think housing definitely has been a source of strength. House prices increasing kind of a lot, and you see housing starts being extremely high. I feel like there's got to be an upper bound to housing starts somehow, right? Like, at one point, like, all the vacant lots will be filled or all the contractors will be filled, and there'll just be capacity constraints on that. But, like, the housing market continues to boom outside of the major cities.
It's out of control. I mean, in my little suburb of Chicago, it is, you know, you have the low end, the mid range, and the high range, right? The houses in the very high range tend to sit a little bit longer, but if you get anything in that sweet spot, it is gone before you blink, or it's listed off market and sold before it even hits the market. The demand for good homes, but not the mansions, is just in the suburbs of Chicago. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I think that's the same story everywhere. You know, so on the darker side, the number of people whose mortgages are in forbearance sort of continues to increase. Some people have come back. So right now, there's sort of a million homes in sort of typical forbearance. There's 1.5 million in, who were in forbearance and are now paying normally. And there's almost 3 million people who are in sort of extended forbearance, which is not supposed to happen, right? In normal times, like, you don't pay your mortgage for 6 months and they start to get persnickety. So here, like, a lot of banks seem to be pushing the can down the road. So we'll have to keep an eye on that.
So John, in the underlying data of these mortgage forbearances, are there statistics on the average home price that's in forbearance? Right. You know, if you have a lot of these jobs being lost at the lower end of the income market, is there geographical areas that are seeing higher forbearances, or is there an income level seeing higher, or a median home price that is above or below the U.S. average? Is there any of that data available?
You know, that data is not public, so people definitely collect it, but we don't have access to it. I mean, some of that data comes out with a lag. So I think in a couple of months, we may be able to answer that question a little bit better, certainly about the regional side. I'm not so sure about the segmented by house value. So that information is definitely there, and there's definitely people who look at it, but
yeah,
we don't have access to it.
And then, and I guess a question more so than a comment with the building prices, right? So you see it if you watch or you read any of the financial news networks or read the financial publications, building materials, the costs have been skyrocketing. At what point does that impact the demand for housing starts? Like you said, like, you have these only so many lots that you can build a home on. There's only so many people that can build you a home, but there continues to be higher and higher housing starts with the cost of the building materials going higher and higher and higher.
Yeah. So there are lumber futures.
which are like 2x4s, big huge pallets of 2x4s. They don't trade very much, but they're there. And you know, they sort of went from, let's say, $400-ish to about $1,000, another back down to $600, the lumber futures. And then, you know, also, like, I bet you if you just look at like Home Depot or Lowe's, I think Lowe's is less exposed to the city centers. Look at their stock prices. That's not a terrible way to see what's going on with like home builders. And they're still,
I mean, firsthand, I have an elevated deck behind my house. And so there's about 5 feet of clearance underneath that deck, and it's just dead space. So I don't have a lot of storage. So I wanted to build a little, I wanted to frame it out essentially, right? Make like a little storage room underneath my deck. The guy came out and quoted me like a month and a half ago, and it was not outrageously expensive. And so I said, let's do it. He texted me last night. And he said, hey, the cost of a 2x4 was $350 and now it's $7. He's like $7. So you have 100% increase in the price of the 2x4. He's like, you know, I need to adjust the bid if I'm going to come out and do it on Saturday. So it's fresh in my mind. That's why I asked. And it seems like, you know, I'm doing a small little project that the price of the project increased by like $200 because of the increase in lumber. But if you're building a house and you're quoted something and then all of a sudden that price jumps, you know, tens of thousands of dollars versus a couple hundred dollars for my project, yep. I think that would start to maybe sway your opinion on building a new home.
Yeah, I mean, I saw one quote that was saying that $15,000 for a typical home had increased this, but I'm not really.
As much as I thought it would be, but still real money, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, like it's the labor is a lot more than the labor and the land are what's expensive, and the stuff is not as expensive. Though, I mean, it adds up, obviously. Right. And like, I don't know whether it's the same thing. If it's everything is doubling, right? That if it's the drywall and the lumber and the paint, if that, all that is increasing, that can add up.
That kind of wraps up a lot of the main data points that are released over the past 5 or 6 days. You know, one of my favorite parts of the podcast is when we go down like a rabbit hole because you read and have access to and care about these little data points that I think matter and are super interesting when you talk about them. So beginning the podcast, you said you had a couple interesting things you've been looking at. What are those?
There's a couple things that come out. One is a credit availability report, which is basically a survey where the Fed once in a while and quarterly asks bankers like, how's your lending status? And that is extremely reduced, right? So it's at extremely low levels. So one of the things that happened in the slow recovery from the global financial crisis is, you know, the Fed is just like shoveling money out the window and nothing's happening, right? Pushing on a string. Why is that? Well, they don't shovel money to people. They shovel money to banks. And if people don't want to borrow or banks don't want to lend, then like you can stuff, you know, you can increase the amount of money in deposit banks, you know, 50 times and nothing's going to happen if the banks won't lend or people don't want to borrow. That's worth keeping an eye on too, right? Credit availability is much lower. Banks are not eager to lend money to people or firms. That is worrying. That's low and falling.
All right. Well, I think, John, that wraps up our comments for the week.
Yep. That's all I got.
For a week with trend line data, I think there was a lot of interesting comments. So thanks for all of those kind of behind the scenes stuff that you can't really get by reading a newspaper. Hopefully that's why our listeners come to the podcast. So, well, John,
you can only get it here
from Mr. John Eckstein.
So next week we get durable goods orders, we get more house price numbers, some preliminary employment information, as well as the claims numbers, and we will get the regular ISM PMI numbers. And the following week we will have the payroll numbers.
The ever important jobs numbers. Okay, thank you. That wraps it up. We will talk to you next week. Everyone have a safe and relaxing weekend.
Thanks, Mac.
See you, John. Bye-bye.
Bye.
To learn more about Aster Investment Management's research and strategies, please visit us on the web at www.asterim.com or stay up to date by following us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and our app is also available on the App Store and Google Play. Thank you. Aster Investment Management, LLC, is a SEC-registered investment advisor. All information contained herein is for informational purposes only. This is not a solicitation to offer investment advice or services in any state where to do so would be unlawful. Analysis and research are provided for informational purposes only, not for trading or investing purposes. All opinions expressed are as of the date of publication and subject to change. They are not intended as investment recommendations.